This text is by Ramana Maharshi, and it's a text that Swamiji's taught. I taught it a long time ago, but it's really, especially, I like the whole text, but the first few verses are really beautiful, so I thought we might as well do it and kind of see how Ramana's process of unfolding this vision. He tends to go primarily just from what we call the Dvampada, you know, unfolding the vision really only in reference to the self without putting too much emphasis at all on Ishvara. But his type of unfoldment is really, really beautiful, so good verses. Let me try it. So, let's do a sahana there too. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punantu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So repeat after me. I ordered some books for us, they just haven't gotten here yet, so we'll just do these little handouts until the books come. Om Om Sat Pratyaya Kin Vihaya Santam. Om Sat Pratyaya Kin Vihaya Santam. Pradyesha Chinta Rahito Hridakyaha. Pradyesha Chinta Rahito Hridakyaha. Katam Smaramas Tamameyamekam. Katam Smaramas Tamameyamekam. Tasyas metis tadrudai vanishta. Tasyas metis tadrudai vanishta. Were you there?
No, we weren't.
I wasn't hearing full participation.
Call it soft yard.
Is everybody there now?
We're facing
page 5.
Oh, I see.
We're on page 5.
Yeah, because it didn't.
At the bottom. Oh, and for you at the top, if you don't do the. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody have it? Susan, do you have it? You?
Mm-hmm, yeah, we just have the one page. So
okay, good.
I think I have one.
Okay, repeat after me. Om Sat Pratyayav Kinnu Vihaya Santam. Om Sat Pratyayav Kinnu Vihaya Santam. Hridyesha Chinta Rahito Hridakyaha. Hridyesha Chinta Rahito Hridakyaha. Katam Smaramas Tamameyamekam. Katam Smaramas Tamameyamekam. Tasya Smritis Tatra Dhritaiva Nishta. Tasya Smritis Tatra Dhritaiva Nishta. Sandhi. Sat Darshanam. Sat Darshanam. Sat Pratyayaha Kim Nu Vihaya Santam. Hridi Eshaha Chinta Rahitaha Hrit Akyaha Katam Smaramaha Tam Ameyam Ekam Tasya Smritihi Tatra Tridha Eva Nishta. Sat Darshanam. Darshanam comes from the root drish, which means to see. Right? Darshanam means seeing. Darshanam, seeing. Sat Darshanam means seeing of that which is. Sat, the word sat or satyam, means that which is true, that which is real. That which is true or real, we have to have a definition of that, because definitions will differ, right? So you have to understand from the Vedantic perspective, what do we consider as something that is real or true or actually existent? So we would say that something is or something exists which can't be negated in past, present, or future. So we give a negative definition. You can say that which always is in past, present, or future. But we tend to put it negatively, that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. Which means it's not bound by time, it's changeless. Okay? So, Sat Darshanam is the vision or the recognition, the seeing of what is true. Because in the whole, what we call the Darshana system, you need a pencil?
Sorry.
Okay. You know, in India they have what's called the Shuddha Darshana system, and even the Buddhism Charvakas and also the Sikhs are outside of that system, but they're all considered Darshanas. So when we say in India the Shuddha Darshanas are the six, in English they translate it as the six philosophical systems, but that's not how they view themselves. They view themselves as a Darshana. Means that particular teaching tradition is meant to make you see, to recognize directly and immediately the nature of reality, the nature of Sat, the nature of what is. And so whatever the teaching methodology is, whether it be Sankhya or Yoga or the Vaisheshikas or the Nyayayikas, all of these different names for these philosophical traditions, his spiritual traditions, everyone is considered a darshana, means it's a teaching methodology that is meant to make you directly realize the nature of reality. Because the nature of reality, the knowledge of the nature of reality is liberation. That means that the cause for your suffering, the cause for your bondage, is ignorance of the nature of reality. And so the means, how the different means of knowledge or what the means of knowledge are that are being used to make a student recognize the nature of reality differs. Even what is considered a pramana for direct immediate knowledge differs. The way to gain that differs. But for all of them consider themselves to be a darshana, which means it's not just theoretical. It's something to actually be recognized, you know, through a means of knowledge or a teaching methodology that goes beyond teaching methodology which points to something which is other than or in addition to or of a different realm of reality than what you are constrained to perceive through your five sense organs and means of knowledge that are based upon your five sense organs. Like, for instance, my vision is now limited to what I perceive, and also sort of any inferences that I might make or presumptions I make, different types of means of knowledge, all of those are in the end limited to what I perceive. Like, for instance, if I make an inference that there's that there's a fire on the hill because I see smoke, I am seeing the smoke. And I also know that there's an invariable relationship between smoke and fire, which I also know because I see it. See what I mean? And so if you want to gain knowledge of a reality that is not subject to coming and going, is not bound by time, it's not something that can be objectifiable, that type of thing, can't be football or something. Right?
No, that bug that was flying around went into the lamp and smoked.
Smoke shepherd. Poor bug's room. This is a good place to just smoke up. Okay. So, anyway, what I'm saying is that this recognition, you know, of something, just think about it. When they talk about something that is bondage and liberation, it's bandhana and moksha, bondage and liberation. What is considered bondage is that which is continually subject to birth and death, continually subject to change. That's bondage, because that means that any experience that you have, sukha and dukkha, or I'd say dukkha, sorrow, and sukha, are all time-bound. That means there is no constant, there's no place to rest your head. Because wherever you rest, that resting can be taken away at any time. Whatever situation that you find that is whole and complete, immediately a fear will rise, because you know very well, the psyche is not stupid. It knows very well that this will only last for so long. Because everything within duality is subject to coming and going, and therefore it doesn't fit the definition of Sat. of reality, because the definition of reality is that which doesn't come and go, that which can't be negated in past, present, or future. And the recognition of that in reference to your being, right, is considered moksha, right? Moksha is the recognition of that which is real, is not something to come and coming and going. We'll see why that is, because you could say, what if this thing, whatever it is that we call sat, being, existence itself, is dukkha? What if your nature is dukkha? And it never goes. So that means you're only covering over this dukkha every now and then. That would be not very, very liberating. Okay, so we have to understand here. So put that aside for now. We're going to be working for now on what we mean by sat. And the point here is that in terms of our experience as an individual in the world with the sense organs that we have available to us, sat is not something available to our recognition. Because all of our means of knowledge can only give us what is nitya, or what is time-bound, what is asat, right? Which is not something that lasts and is present in all three periods of time. It can't deliver that. So now if we say, as this book of Ramana is titled, Sad Darshanam, means the recognition, the vision, the direct recognition of that which is non-negatable in past, present, or future. The instant I say that, then you have to say, well, what means of knowledge is available to me for the recognition of that? And where is that located? If I want to have a darshana, a vision, an understanding of sat, where am I going to find that? And the instant you say where, we're into time and space and place. If we're into time and space and place, we're not going to be able to find it, because within time and space, within the whole manifest creation on any level, there is no such thing as sat, which we can perceive as an object, as a name and form within the creation. So you can see sat darshanam means this sad darshanam is only about the revealing of that which you really can't perceive as an object through sense perception, and therefore you can't even infer it. You have no means of knowledge to get to it, which is interesting. It means it can't exist within time and space. Just think about that. If sat, or if sat, can't exist within time and space, means it cannot be objectified. You see that? Just try to visualize this, because it's important. If you can't objectify, even with telescopes and microscopes, you don't, with any type of instrumentation, you can't objectify what is sat. Because anything that you can objectify exists within time and space. And that immediately negates the definition of what sat is. It's not possible to objectify. And yet, we're talking about sat darshanam. We're talking about the seeing, the recognizing of that sat. So, if it's not objectifiable within the time and space creation, when they say time and space, they don't just mean the physical creation. Anything, even the subtle creation, subtle realms, or even the levels of the mind, levels of the psyche, subtle realms for astral travelers, in different lokas, anything that exists within duality won't fit that definition of sat, because sat is not something that can exist within time and space, because if it exists within time and space, it's subject to change. So what is left out? What is left out is that which is, but which is not objectifiable as an object. That which is, but is not objectifiable as an object. Who would that be? There's only one place to go for it. There's only one place to go. Give it like this. Right now, at this moment, at any moment, we can divide our experience into two. two categories, subject and object. That's it. In terms of our experience, subject and object. Anything that can be an object exists within time and space by its very nature, because if it can be an object, then I can differentiate it from something else. If I can describe it, then it's differentiated from something else. For that, we have two things we require. Space. And any object is divisible and bound by constant change and all of that. So, now, in our experience, there is subject-object. I'm the subject, you're the object. Sorry. You're the object.
Okay? I'm the subject.
Yeah, right. I'm the subject. Everything that I perceive is the object. Nothing that I perceive is subject. Because everything I perceive is subject to objectification, and they're subject to birth and death, subject to change. And so all of you immediately fall into the category of sut and of a sut, of what is objectifiable. And of course, I fall into the category of being objectifiable for all of you. But that's not even true. What's even more real than that is that, in fact, all of you are objectifiable, and everything in the creation, in fact, is objectifiable, including my body, to me. I'm aware of my body through my five sense organs, just as you're aware of your body through your five sense organs. If you removed your five sense organs, then you're not aware of your body. If you're blind, you can't see your body. If you're deaf, you can't hear it click, you know? If you lose your sense of touch, you can't feel it. You're aware of this world through your five sense organs. And so it's not just the world that you're aware of through the five sense organs, it's the world including your body that you're aware of. And, of course, anything that I can objectify and that exists within time and space is not sut. It's not sut, because it's subject to birth and death, and this body is. And similarly, my sense organs are objectifiable. You know, the ones that objectify this body and this, the sense organs themselves are objectifiable. And so they also are not sut, because they can come and go. Any sense organ does come and go. And so your sense organs aren't sut, my sense organs aren't sut, no sense organs are sut. The vrittis, the thought modifications in your mind, because of which you're aware of your sense organs, which are aware of your body and the world, those vrittis, those thought modifications also are not sut, because they also change and are continually coming and going and are objectifiable. You see that? You know your thoughts, you know. You know your moods, you know your emotions, you know your feelings. They're objectifiable, so they're not sut, because it's constantly changing. The ahankara, the I notion itself. I am this, I am that, the one that I'm identifying with all your experiences. That also is not sut, because the I thought is coming and going. You don't have to walk around with an I thought all the time, with a labeling thought, a thought that labels yourself. Like, say you're walking to the store, and then you say, oh, I'm walking to the store. You don't have to keep saying that. You have to keep saying, I'm walking to the store, I'm walking to the store. You don't have to keep saying that. It's just a vritti. It's a thought. It's not necessary. It's a label, like any other label. So if you start thinking, okay, all of our experience here is subject-object, when we start trying to tune in to the nature of the subject, how are we going to do that? If I say, this whole world can be divided into subject-object, and I want to differentiate really, thoughtfully, between the subject and the object, me the subject, and everything else is the object. To do that, I have to go, I can't have this body remain as the subject, because I realize that it's also an object. I can't have my sense organs remain ultimately as the subject, because they also are objectified. I can't have the buddhi, my mind, remain as a subject, because it also is objectified. I can't have the I thought. And they all come and go. Well, we all know they come and go. We don't have a problem with that. It's a fact. They all come and go. The I thought I can't remain as the subject. So what is going to remain as the subject for you? Ultimately. We call it the pratyagatma. What will ultimately remain as the subject is only that which can't be objectified. That's it. If it can be objectified, then there's a subject objectifying it. If it can be looked at, if it can be described, if it's something that changes and I'm the witness of its change, that's not you. That's an experience which is taking place, but it's not you. It's not your being. And so because you remain objectifying this thing, whatever it is, and this thing, whatever you're objectifying, comes and goes, and you remain. And so as long as you can objectify anything, you are then, at that moment, differentiating yourself from what you're objectifying. That's how we use the word, right? But when you get to who you are at the bottom line then. There's not any more objectification possible. So the bottom line for you is going to be you, the existent, the one who says, I say the words, I am, you know, I am. That's referring to you as an existent being. You're not those words, but those words are referring to you as an existent being. And I'm a conscious existent being. I am the one who is ultimately the subject that illumines everything. I am the conscious being that myself cannot objectify. I can't objectify consciousness to where there is now consciousness of an object consciousness, where the subject is differentiated from the object. I can say, I illumine the thoughts, and I can describe the thoughts and watch them change. But I can't illumine consciousness to where there is me, the conscious being, aware of me, the conscious being, as though there is a conscious being aware of a conscious being that is other than me. Do you see what I mean? No differentiation. And yet, I'm aware of myself. I'm the bottom line. Consciousness is aware of itself, but not as an object. Not as an object. It's aware of itself because it's consciousness. Consciousness being consciousness is what we say is self-evident, self-effulgent. And how does that play out in all of your experience? Every experience that you have, this is filled with the self, my own self-evident presence, because of which everything is illumined, but which itself doesn't require another consciousness to come in and illumine it. You don't have to bring in a consciousness to illumine consciousness. Consciousness is consciousness. And so just think of it like this. Every single experience that you have, like this room, it is an experience. And so we say everything in this room, it is. I'm aware of it, and it is. Okay? Now, say you go outside, you know, just to work with the physical reality. Go outside. Everything that I'm aware of, right? I'm aware of it. It's in my consciousness, I can say, however language I want to use. And it is. If I look at this way, if I turn my glance this way, everything is in my consciousness. Everything is. Now I turn here. This is gone now. Everything is. Everything is in my consciousness. Everything is. If I shut all down all my sense organs and just watch my mind, the thoughts in my mind, my moods, the thought is in my consciousness, the thought is. The mood is in my consciousness, the mood is. Say if I go into just the I thought, the ahankara itself, the I, you say that I thought is in my consciousness, it is. What if I'm meditating and I'm turning the mind toward the conscious one, the conscious being that's illumining it, then what I would say is what? Right? The consciousness is illumining the mind that's becoming a mirror that's focused on my consciousness. What if I totally absorb the mind in the consciousness, then what do I say? You don't say anything because the mind's absorbed in consciousness. But what is that recognition? It's just simply, I am a conscious being. There's nothing required behind that other than that to illuminate. And so what I'm saying here is that your presence is what fills every experience, and itself remains free of every experience, because there is no experience that's ever without it. And so actually, in a sense, self-knowledge is easy. It's very subtle, but it's very simple also. Because self-knowledge, yourself, your being, is the only thing that doesn't come and go. There is nothing else. There is nothing within creation that doesn't come and go, that isn't bound by change. There's only one thing that is stable, and that is conscious being itself, Satchit. And so here, Ramana says, he asks a question, Sat Pratyaya. A pratyaya is another word for vritti. Vritti is a thought modification. So he says, a vritti of something which is a sat pratyaya means, take a thought on any thought modification. I say that thought is, that pratyaya is. Say I have a vritti, a thought modification of this room through my sense organs. This room then, this thought modification, this pratyaya, it is. Everything in this room is. So I can say, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. So I have a pratyaya, I have a vritti, you know, which is. And any vritti you have is going to have that sat aspect to it. Just think of it. Imagine a vritti, a thought modification, where there is no sat, where there is no being, there is no existence. And so what he says here is, you know, how can there be a pratyaya, a vritti, a thought modification, which exists, which enjoys being, right? Vihayasantam, without there being any being. How can you have a vritti, a thought modification, an experience, which is devoid of being? That's what he says. How is it possible? Is it possible to have a sat pratyaya, meaning a pratyaya of something which you say it is, you know, without there being any being, without there being any existence? Is it possible? So just understand what he says. When you have a thought, any thought, there's four things present in your thought. Sat, chit, right? Thought is, and it is known. That's the sat and the chit. That's true in any thought. And then there's the name and form. Sat and chit, this is from Drikta Shivivekya. The sat and the chit, the consciousness and the being, and the name and form in any vritti that you have. So here, in this vritti, if you just take the room, the vritti, the thought modification of the room, it is, right? And it is known. That's the sat chit. It belongs to the vritti. It is and it is known. And then, what is and what is known are all the nama rupa, all of the names and forms. So I can break my experience into that. It is known. And what is and what is known? The name and form. Everybody clear on that? Now, that's true for every pratyaya, every vritti that you have, every thought modification that you have. It is and it is known. So another way to say it, there are nama rupas, there are names and forms that make up the thought modification, and those names and forms are and they are known. Okay, so here's vritti number one. Names and forms, they exist, and they are known. Next vritti. First vritti is gone. What is gone in the first vritti? The first vritti goes, the names and forms are gone. Second vritti comes, new names and forms. But what remains, it is and it is known. Next vritti comes, different names and forms. But it is known. Next vritti, it is known. In the isness and the knownness of the vritti, there's no motion. There is no coming and going. In fact, the isness of the vritti and the knownness of the vritti is not something that you can objectify. The isness and the knownness is you the conscious being. And that remains as the constant. The vritti, the name and form, is what comes and goes. And so that's true on a sensory level, it's true on an emotional level, it's true on an intellectual level, it's true on an imaginal level. There's something, the sat-chit, the set of the pratyaya, the sat-chit of the vritti, it never wavers. But the names and forms come and go. So he says, how can you even imagine a vritti of something which is without the isness? Without the sat. How can you imagine it? You can't. But the sat is not something that's objectifiable. The name and form are objectifiable. So then he says, hridi eshaha chinta rahitaha. This sat he's talking about, this is something which this sat is chinta rahitaha. It is itself free of any thought. Rahita means free of. This sat, which is hridi esha, eshaha means sat. The esha means this. This which is in this sat, this being, the being that I am, which is in the buddhi, hrit. Hrit means in the heart. Heart means buddhi, in the mind. This sat, which is there in the mind, is itself chinta rahitaha. It's free of the mind. It's free of thought. The sat which is in the mind is itself free of thought. And yet it is called the buddhi. It is called the buddhi. It is called the heart. So this is interesting. I can say, in reference to my mind, I say, I am a conscious being. My mind is talking. It's the ahankara. I am a conscious being. So now, I am a conscious being. The conscious being that I am, which is itself free of thought, right, is called the mind. It's called the hrit. It's called the heart. And that's true. This is exactly what he's bringing in here, is the satyam mitya. So if I take my mind, if I just look at my mind, you know, I abide in my mind. I am the conscious, as though I abide in my mind. I'm the conscious being which the mind enjoys. You can't imagine your mind. You can't imagine a mind without sat-chit, without being and without consciousness. Right? That you can't have a thought which is free of or devoid of being and consciousness. It's even a non-issue. Every thought you have in your mind is going to enjoy being and consciousness. It's going to enjoy sat as its very nature. But the thing is, the sat, your being, is not something, you know, which is dependent on thoughts. And so your thoughts enjoy your being is free from your thoughts. Your thoughts depend on your being for their being, but your being doesn't depend on them for its being. That's the satyam nitya. And so here it says, this which is sat, which exists in the buddhi, just like clay exists in the pot, right? How clay exists in the pot, the sat-chit exists in the buddhi, and yet that sat-chit is chinta rahitaha. Means my being is totally free. My being is totally free of any type of thought or movement. And yet it is called akya. It is called the buddhi. Right? So like the buddhi says, I the buddhi, I the mind am a conscious being. I am the conscious being. Right? I am me. When you say that, you say I am me, you're talking about you as a conscious sentient being. and you take that conscious sentient being to be one with the buddhi, one with the intellect. So the intellect says, I am a conscious being, and that is absolutely true, just like the pot saying, I am the clay. Isn't it the clay? Of course it's the clay. What else is it? So my buddhi says, my mind says, I am the conscious being. But the thing is that the conscious being, which that mind is totally free of the mind. The conscious being is not thinking. Thoughts take place in silence. Thoughts take place in awareness, right? The awareness isn't thinking. If the awareness was thinking and the thoughts are thinking, then you have a problem. The consciousness itself is not doing any activity at all. So the mind totally depends for its being on consciousness, but consciousness itself is totally free of being. This is why, like when you contemplate, when you just kind of relax and let yourself become just aware of your thoughts, you just sit quietly and become aware of your thoughts, there's two things happening. There's my presence, which is not changing, and the thoughts which are passing through. There's a presence which is constant, which is not thinking, which just does not have emotions, which is whole and complete and free. And that being is the very self of the thinking, of the emoting, of the imagining, of the perceiving, the very self of it. But itself is not doing anything. And so this is something that needs to be recognized. This relationship is what we call satya mitya. There is sat. Sat means that which can never be negated in past, present, or future. That sat is me. And it is never negated in past, present, future. I'm always the same. There's not a moment to moment for me. I am the presence of every moment. And I'm the presence which is the truth of and illumines every moment. I'm not coming and going. And so that being, the being which is me, is the satyam. What is coming and going is what we call mitya. Mitya means it comes into being and goes out of being, into being and goes out of being, has no being of its own. Something comes into being and goes out of being like a thought, that doesn't have any reality from its own standpoint because it's bordered by non-existence. It comes into being and goes out of being. When it's gone, it's gone. Before it comes, it wasn't there. But whatever comes and goes is, because the isness, which is sat, you know, is what blesses every experience. That's why we have such a sense of continuity, because I am the satyam, I am the continuity, I am the changeless, timeless continuity, the changeless, timeless presence that is the truth of every moment, is the changeless truth of every moment, that of every vritti that comes and goes within me. But I'm not changing. And so for me, there's perfect continuity. Right? Because there's no modification taking place for me. And so if a mithya vritti, a vritti that itself has no being independent of me, comes into being and goes out of being, that doesn't touch me at all. Because I'm not coming into being and going out of being. So I don't feel affected, you know? Because I don't feel affected because I'm not affected. It's the same, you know, when you wake up from a dream. You wake up from a dream, complex dream. You're very involved in it. The alarm goes off. The dream is gone. But the dream goes and nothing happens. You know? The dream was so real. But when the dream goes, nothing happens. Because the being, the truth of the dream, hasn't moved at all. The self of the dream, which is you, the being of the dream, hasn't gone through any type of modification at all. You are the self of the dream. The dream goes, you remain. And so even in your mind, you think, oh, that dream seems so real. You don't say, the dream was a reality that is now left. It's the dream seemed so real when it was there. But now it's gone, and the truth of it remains. You know? The set shit remains. So here, we say, this buddhi that's called the buddhi, you know. The atma, the self, is easily called the buddhi, you know. You think of it, you think of your buddhi as your mind, you know, as being the self, because the mind is the self. What you don't recognize until you do is that the mind is the self, but the self is free of the mind. So that's what it says here. In the mind, this sat, the sat, which is my own presence, is free of thought. And at the same time, it is called the mind. It's called the hrit. Hrit can also mean the essence of something. But you can also take it as this way, to take it as the satya mitya. You say, I am my mind, but an ajnani, somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, says, I am my mind. But somebody who has self-knowledge says, I am my mind and I am free of my mind. I am my mind, I am free of my mind. Like what if the pot says, I am the clay, you know, I am the clay, and I am the clay and I'm free of, I am, the pot says, I am the clay, and the clay is free of me. You know? So what if from the standpoint of myself as such it, I can say, I am the mind. But I also have to be able to say, I am free of the mind. Okay? Or I could say, the mind has no being apart from me, but I am free of it. That's the satyamitya. That's what you have to recognize. It's true in every experience. Your being is something which is beyond time. It's free of time. Well, if it's free of time, what that means is that the you that is present right now, that is so dear to you as you, this very being that you are, if you go back in time, you know, say you go back 5 billion years, we'll go back as far as we want, 5 billion years. The very presence that is here right now as you is what is the very presence that's illumining this creation 5 billion years ago. If you go 5 billion years in the future, the very self that is illuminating that moment, this moment, and future moment is exactly the same, because timeless, free of time, you know? And so the universe and time take place in me, but I'm the very presence that illumines the time. So then he says, okay, then he says, katam smaramaha tam ameyamekam. How, katam means how. How can we know? Katam smaramaha. How can we know tam, that sat, which is only one, ekam, that sat, which must be only one, because not objectifiable. Time and space are objectifiable. Consciousness, sat, is not objectifiable. If it's not objectifiable, there's no space to make for two. There can't be two. And so that means this conscious being that I am, that is non-objectifiable, is only one. There's only one of us. There's only one conscious being. So how can we know? How are we able to know this one, which is this conscious being, this sat, which is only one, and which is ameyam? Means it's not something that can be limited or objectified. How ameyam means it can't be known. It can't be objectified, like pramana, prameyam. How can we know it then, if it's not objectifiable? So he says, it's a good question. I mean, how are you going to know something that you can't objectify and have a subject-object relationship? He says, tasya smritihi, the knowledge of that, the smriti means the recognition of that, tasya smritihi, is tatra vrida eva nishta, is only in your abiding there. Means that is only in the dridha nishta, means to be firmly rooted. Dridha means firmly, nisha, to fully recognize that, to be firmly rooted in that, to be firmly rooted there. So this is the idea then. How can you be firmly rooted? So he says, how can we know that? He says, the only way that there can be recognition of that is to know that, is to recognize yourself as that, for the mind to have recognized yourself as that without wavering. That's the only way. Because see, look at, sometimes knowledge, when we talk about gaining self-knowledge, it's actually viewed negatively. It's called Ajnana Nivritti. To gain self-knowledge is viewed negatively as the negation of ignorance, the elimination of ignorance. The reason for that is yourself, your presence, is not something that requires a means of knowledge to light you up. Consciousness doesn't require another consciousness to come in and give you knowledge of consciousness. Right? Where nothing else in the world is like that. If, for instance, if I want to see that painting, I have to light that painting up with my eyes and form a thought modification in my mind that consciousness illumines. Right? Because it's not self-luminous. But what needs to come in and light up consciousness? Do I need to bring another consciousness in to light it up? Or do I need the mind to light it up? The mind which is self being lit up by consciousness? See that? So consciousness, the experience, the conscious experience, the self experience, is something with or without knowledge is the bottom line given. In other words, all of you will say, I am an existent being. Your existence is something which is taken for granted and because of which everything else is known. Right? You say, I'm a conscious being, and because I'm a conscious being, I'm aware of this, this, and this, and this. Then you go into an infinite regress and say, I am a conscious being, but the consciousness which I am requires another conscious being to come in and illuminate so it can be conscious. That would be an infinite regress. See what I mean? And then you need another conscious being to illumine that. So you have consciousness of consciousness of consciousness of consciousness. So, there's a bottom line here. The bottom line is the conscious being that you are that cannot be objectified. Okay? Who's going to light that up? Who's going to make that conscious being shine? That's why we say consciousness itself is what we call swaprakashatva. It's self-shining. You know? Because of it, everything else shines. Nothing is required to make it shine. And so for whether, even with or without self-knowledge, yourself as a conscious being is known. You have what we call samanya jnanam. You have a general knowledge. I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. No problem. Everybody will say that. Even any ajnani, any person without self-knowledge will say that. I'm a conscious being. But then if I ask you, what's responsible for that consciousness that makes you a conscious being? Then you say, I don't know. What if I ask you, is the conscious being that you are the same as the conscious being this part person is? I don't know. All I know is I'm a conscious being. How do you know? Well, because it's self-evident. I know I'm a conscious being. That's the bottom line. No problem. It's self-shining. It's self-evident. That's not the problem. The problem is I don't know what this self-shining conscious being is. I don't know who I am. Am I the self-shining conscious being, an epiphenomena of the body? Is it something that, you know, is it something that the body produces, this consciousness? Is it a little bubble of consciousness that's existing within the creation? What is this conscious being that makes me me? I don't know that. And so, it is not the experience of yourself as a conscious being that you need to have revealed to you. That's already fully revealed. I don't need sense organs to reveal that to me. It's a given, because consciousness is self-evident. Your being is self-evident. But I have to remove the ignorance that stops me from having a particular knowledge of who I am. I know that I'm a conscious being, but I don't know that I'm the one non-dual conscious being which is the self of the whole universe. That I don't know. But the conscious, but that I am a conscious being, I know. But I go to the guru, I go to my teacher to say, is there anything about me that is free of death? Do I die? This conscious being that I am, do I die? Right? Am I also subject to birth and death, or am I a product of this body? Who am I? But I'm asking about me, who is self-evident, but I don't know the details. So I have to remove the ignorance of the details. You see what I mean? Not that you are a conscious being. That's why, you know, in the tenth man story, when the tenth man is told by the wise old man, after counting the other fellows, that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you are the tenth man. You know, when he says that you are the tenth man, it is not that that person, the tenth man in that story, is not fully experientially aware of himself. It's not like when the old man counts the other nine and points, you are the tenth man, that he is having a new self experience. That's not it at all. The one that he took to be himself, he is realizing, is the tenth man. The experience that was already totally present is now recognized as the tenth man. And now here, the self, yourself, that you take to be this physical body, mind, sense, organs, to be one with it, that with your very sense, the me, you know, it's like the pot that takes itself to be the clay. It is the clay. When that pot recognizes, I am the clay, but the clay that I am is free, right? It already knew it was its experience was of being clay, but it didn't realize that the clay was free of the pot, right? It didn't know that. So for you, when you say I am, you're taught who the one you're referring to is Brahman. It's not anybody else. The self experience fully, completely, the Brahman is fully, completely you right now. But you take this you to be a product of this body and limited. And what you recognize is, oh my gosh, the I that I had taken to be one with this physical body and therefore finite and bound to birth and death, this I is free. It is timeless. I never change in any way. I can't die. I can't become better and I can't become worse. I'm whole and complete and I'm changeless. I had not recognized that before because I had taken myself to be one with the experiences that were coming and going. And so then the question is, well, how am I going to know this self? Well, you already are that self. The ajnanam, the ignorance that causes you to project your being onto these changing experiences has to be severed. That ignorance has to be removed. And when that ignorance is fully removed, then what? Then you have dritta nishtha in your own sense of self. You don't think. You don't fall into this thing, well, I am this body, I am this mind, or behave as such. Your self-concept is you, is true to who you are. That's dritta nishtha. That's being firmly rooted in yourself, in the recognition of yourself, as opposed to having superimposed yourself onto all of these changing objectifiable experiences. So that's the only way to know. You know, it's not, you're not going to gain a new knowledge of you. You're going to gain a, remove the ignorance that has caused you to project yourself, you know, to superimpose yourself on experiences that are coming and going. Which, the only reason there's just not been any viveka, any discrimination in operation. Because otherwise, how could you superimpose yourself on something that wasn't here a moment ago and is gone the next moment? It's not possible, and you're still here. You're still here. You do that all the time. You know, because I am the constant of absolutely everything. You know, and so I take for granted the ground of being that I am, which is the ground of being in everything, you know? And so I'm only looking at the universe of experience through my sense organs and differentiating one thing from another, not recognizing the ground of being, my own changeless presence, which is there equally in every experience that I have. I'm absolutely taken for granted. And now we have to Instead of differentiating one object from another, one person from another, one thought, one type of thinking from another, I now have to differentiate all of these things from my own stable presence that lights up the whole thing. The one stable presence that lights up the whole thing. And what do I recognize about that non-objectable presence, which is me, non-objectifiable presence, which is me, is that this me is the only me that there is. There aren't two me's. Me, the me, when you say me or I, these words me, I, they're referring to the very personal me that I am. But this personal me lights up all beings. The very personal me that I am is the personal me that is the I, you know, is what all beings label as I. Every one of us says, I, this very personal being that I am, right? I realize is free from all of the objectifiable limitations. It's the very personal being that I am is the self of all beings. This very personal me that makes me is the self of Ishwara, is the self of the whole. That is the Mahavakya, that this whole universe has me for itself. I am the self of the whole universe. Right? Not this body is the self of the whole universe, not the sense organs is the self of the whole universe, or the mind. These are all objectifiable. They are all part and parcel of Ishwara. But the consciousness that I am is the consciousness that you are, or that the plants are, or that your animal is, your pet is, your family is, your enemies are. There's only one me. Right? And that one me is not tainted or touched by anything that is objectifiable. So it is ever free. How do you know that? You already know that completely in terms of samanya jnanam. And when you say I'm an existent conscious being, and you say me, you are referring to that self. But what has to happen is the ignorance that has caused you to superimpose yourself on these changing phenomena of experience needs to be broken. And then you no longer abide as yourself. You don't make that mistake anymore. That's what he calls Dridha Nishtha. This is the only way to know it, is to recognize the truth of yourself, having differentiated from the things that you have superimposed upon it. So that's his first verse. Stop there.
Om Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om